Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast, where we explore the intricate connections between religion and public health. I'm your host, Alejandra Salemi, founder of Healing Theology. Each week, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, experts, clergy, researchers, and scientists who are working to bridge the gap between faith and science. Together, we challenge misconceptions, spark meaningful dialogues, and discover how these two worlds can come together to create healthier, more united societies. Thank you for joining us on this journey of season two. Let's dive in. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Healing Theology Podcast. I'm excited to kick off a two-part series with some incredible people from Oxford for these couple of episodes. So before we get into the conversation, I want to introduce you to one of our guests today as we get ready to have a really interesting and important conversation around peace building. So our guest today is Alejandro Posada Tellez. Alejandro is a PhD candidate in international relations in the University of Oxford. His PhD explores the politics underlying transitions from war to peace, questioning the utility of government-sanctioned narratives about who is the legitimate victims and perpetrators of wartime violence. He analyzes how these dynamics play out in Colombia, Sri Lanka, Sierra Leone, and Northern Ireland. Alejandro holds a BA in politics and international relations from the University of London, a master's in international security from the Sciences Po PSIA, and a master's of science in international relations from the London School of Economics. So Alejandro, thank you so much for being on the podcast. How are you? How are things?
Hi, Alejandra. I'm doing very well, thanks. And I'm delighted to be part of this amazing podcast series.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for kicking us off our little Oxford mini-series. We've had a couple of conversations around your research and your area of focus around peace building. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research and what your current topics of interest are?
Absolutely. Currently, I'm in the latter stages of my PhD. I'm researching, as you said, how conflict-affected societies either move or fail to move from war to peace. I'm specifically interested in how governments choose to address legacies of past violence and the implications of the stories that governments and we ourselves tell each other about a given conflict. More recently, I also did some work on the United Nations as a conflict mediator. That was outside of my PhD. And I published a journal article where I consider how sensitive the organization, the United Nations, is to religious issues, actors, values, norms, and identities when mediating in settings where religion matters in some way or another to conflict parties. And we'll get the chance to talk about both of these soon. And beyond this, I sporadically write about some cross-cutting themes relating to peace building in Colombia, which is my home country, a place that is important to both of us, and where most of my hands-on work has taken place.
Thank you for all of that. And we're not going to get into the specific topic right now, because you and I have talked about like kind of knowing our scope of the work, but there's so much conversation, I think, around the world happening right now around peace building and who's the victim and how do we find reparations in really intense and polarizing conflicts as is happening right now in Palestine and Israel, which we're not going to talk about, not because we don't care about it, but because we want to be very sensitive to the scope of our work and focus on what Alejandro is an expert in. And as we're talking about that, you know, your doctoral research, as you just told us, has themes of peace building, peacemaking, but there's also themes of justice work for victims and perpetrators of violence. I see the connections very clearly because I think that everything is public health and I am public health's best like marketing like agent because I love this field. But can you tell us more about how you see this connecting in the conversations around public health and well-being, the themes of peacekeeping and peace building?
Yes. So the foundational questions that my research asks are, who are the victims of armed conflict, as you mentioned earlier? Who are the perpetrators? Who decides these categories? And what the implications of labeling victims and perpetrators are? Who wins and who loses as a result, essentially? And these questions then open up a big box of Pandora about the ways discourse and narratives transcend to all aspects of public life of people affected by conflict, both directly and indirectly. And of course, public health is one of them. The reason this interests me so much is because at the core of my work is a very deep-seated interest and a concern for the physical and the emotional well-being of people who have been harmed by war. Again, both directly and indirectly. There's different ways to see that. For instance, the set of practices and the institutions that governments tend to use to address these legacies, which is broadly described and conceptualized as transitional justice. It can be a route for greater inclusion, for greater support, dignity. It can be a route into access to resources, to have the needs and requirements of entire communities satisfied, including the physical and psychosocial attention to conflict-affected individuals. And to your question on public health, this interlinking role of justice, I think, can be a very good tool, a very effective tool, to better understand and address health disparities, among other disparities, in societies where those most vulnerable to violence are usually the ones with the least access to quality health services. And it's fascinating to see these connections between current academic discourses in public health and my own research. You know, I focus on truth, on justice, on knowledge. And it's great to see that public health practitioners and political scientists alike are having very active conversations about unfair knowledge practices and power relations, perhaps, and how these unfair power relations and knowledge practices can have a societal impact, and ultimately, how this can be addressed and mitigated in the context of global health. Because at the end of the day, whose truth and knowledge we hold really does shape the world we live in, our practices, our worldviews, our very identities.
Yeah, I appreciate the context that you're building around the kind of aftermath, right? Like after a conflict is resolved, hopefully there's a kind of rebuilding. It sounds like you're almost in the work of rebuilding, and how do we help people get back into a pathway of safety, of health, of flourishing, of like community. Can you explain a little bit more about what this transitional justice, is that what you called it? What is that? I've never heard of that phrase before.
Yes, transitional justice is the ways that societies deal with those legacies of violence. So they can have multiple manifestations. It's a set of practices, institutions, discourses. Usually nowadays, whenever we talk about transitional justice, we tend to refer to special courts, perhaps, that deal with the judicial crime and the judicial truth. So this is a legalistic practice based on the rule of law. But then you also have some non-legal practices that could be truth commissions. It could be units for searching for disappeared people. It could be offices and commissions for giving reparations to victims. So the whole set of practices, discourses, institutions that help societies to move from war to peace following the theoretical ending of a conflict.
There's a paper that you write, and there's a couple of things that you write about the role that religion plays in peacemaking and peace building. Can you tell us more about like what are some of the ways that religion helps in making peace, and at the same time, how might it get in the way?
Religion plays two main roles in conflict and peace. The first is that it is an identity marker. So religion in itself is rarely the central cause that conflicts are fought for, but rather religion reinforces other factors of potential societal division or unity even, which might mirror, you know, class, ethnicity, status, majoritarianism, and at the end of the day, access to resources and to opportunities. In Sri Lanka, for example, which is one of the cases I look at in my doctoral thesis, religion was a very important aspect of Sinhalese and Tamil identities, the two ethnic groups that were fighting each other. During the 1990s and the early 2000s, Buddhist practices and organizations became closely associated with Sinhala nationalism, under this narrative that Buddhism in Sri Lanka had to be preserved, it had to be protected. And in lots of political rallies and in nationalist propaganda, you would see the Buddhist flag and images of the Buddha being leveraged for, you know, instrumentalized for political purposes. On the other hand, Hindu religious and cultural practices also became a part of Tamil resistance and this drive for sovereign statehood that the Tamil population in Sri Lanka had, also has had during decades. With Hindu festivals like Thai Pongal and Deepavali becoming very important sites for community organization and even cultural pride somehow while the conflict was ongoing. Second, and very closely related to the examples that I just gave you, religion is a key social and political mobilizer. And very often we see religious discourses being deployed both to dehumanize an antagonistic other or to mitigate divisions in the name of, you know, these religious values of peace and reconciliation. Religious leaders in many conflict contexts tend to have a very privileged voice to mobilize entire communities in the service of either war or peace. And to give you an example of this, in Northern Ireland, another one of the cases I deal with in my thesis, religious leaders played both roles very actively. You had cases of fiery rhetoric being articulated from the pulpit, like Reverend Ian Paisley, to give you an example. He was part of the Free Presbyterian Church, who rallied up the Protestant community in Northern Ireland to stand up against what he called the Catholic domination. But then you also had cases like Friar Alec Reid, who brought together Republican leaders and British officials in his monastery, in the physical space of his monastery, for early peace negotiations, which would ultimately lead to the Good Friday Agreement. And you also had, I mean, beside Alec Reid, many other figures of the clergy from both communities who very often condemned violence and called for reconciliation.
Yeah, I think you're highlighting something that is a recurring theme in the podcast and in the work of healing theology, which is religion on itself can be a neutral thing, depending on how it's employed. It can be used for good or it can be used for bad, as you're kind of highlighting. And I don't think we've really explored this concept of how much power maybe, or maybe social capital religious institutions have. And, you know, I think most of my personal work and a lot of the work of the guests that we have on the podcast focus in a U.S. context. But I think this is, you know, the U.S. is kind of a weird example of like religion and politics because of its foundation. But across the world, right, there's so much overlap and a collaboration between religious agencies and political agencies as well. And I think there's, you know, I'm sure you could give us a long list of examples of the ways that religion or religious institutions have used their power for bad. But at the same time, there is kind of a, I would say, I don't know if you'd use this language, like a moral responsibility maybe of religious leaders to help kind of broker peace or even like change perspectives, right? Like the ways that we talk about conflict, the way that we talk about the enemy can alter the community's posture when they show up to talk about peace negotiations. I don't know. It just makes me think about, yeah, I think, like I said, the moral responsibility and, like, you know, not that the church should be the hog. It shouldn't be the like lawyers brokering the peace, because I think that there's people for that specifically. But at the same time, you know, I think that we need to acknowledge the power that they hold as well. I would love to hear more about this piece that you've mentioned already that you've published on the United Nations and the understanding of religion in peace mediation processes. Can you tell us about what your process or what your experience was in the UN talking about religious institutions and peace building? Like, do they also totally agree with us in the fact that they have so much social capital, or is that something that is just between us and our listeners?
No, I think the United Nations and all of this big international peacemakers, they do acknowledge the potential of religion, but not necessarily for the right reasons or the reasons that are most conducive to peace. So in that particular article, I argue that the biggest problem of the UN, and again, these other international peacemakers, is that they see religion as inherently detached from politics. As I mentioned earlier, religion can be both a positive and a negative force for peace. But unfortunately, in my view, and based on the research that I did, these big international organizations see themselves as secular. They see themselves as cosmopolitan, as modern, which leads them to see religion as more of a challenge, a hurdle to be overcome in peace processes. And the issue with this simplistic, this very reductive view of religion is that mediators end up with a, let's call it, an elusive understanding of all the different ways in which religion might matter in conflict spaces and to conflict parties. And because of this disconnect, religious organizations and leaders are often brought in too late, or maybe even never, into the conversation surrounding a peace process. My conclusion then is that the UN needs to better understand the messiness of the real world and the complex interplay between religion and sociopolitical and economic life in a conflict context, as doing so can really help the organization make sure that its peacemaking efforts are well and meaningfully directed.
Why do you think that the UN believes that religion and politics are so separated? Because in my head, and again, I recognize that you and I are coming from a place where like we study this all the time, so we can probably see things that are there and things that aren't there. But I'm thinking, you know, like the civil rights in the 60s here was highly led by religious priests and religious leaders. I'm thinking of Gustavo Gutierrez, who like was huge in Latin America, and I think also around the same time around like socialist and kind of more progressive politics, and was devoted to the church, obviously. I'm even thinking like the Church of England, right? Like the whole denomination was created for political reasoning. So I feel like if I can just come up with three quick examples just off the top of my head, how does the UN justify the kind of separation, the kind of pseudo separation of church and state that they pretend is happening globally?
I'm not sure they justify it per se, but religion is too elusive for them to understand. You know, when you've got such a huge international organization that understands itself as, again, secular, cosmopolitan, Western, modern, it's very difficult for an organization like that to really conceive of religion in productive ways and constructive ways that really allow the organization to grasp, again, the different ways in which religion is expressed and manifested in conflict settings. So I think it's just a matter of identity, if I may say it like that, of how an organization understands itself, the kind of work that it does. And instead of justifying its absence, the absence of religion, they deal with a different aspect of conflicts, which is the political one, or at least the element that they see to be different in a conflict context. So again, they see religion as going on one side, they see politics as going on the other, and they focus on the political, they deal with the politicians. But what happens in contexts where politicians and religious leaders are quite intertwined? What happens in cases where, you know, we've got strongman politics and the legitimacy of a religious, of a political leader is derived from religious and spiritual beliefs? So I think this self-understanding of the UN as secular, as modern, as cosmopolitan, as Western, really does prevent it from engaging with religion fully and really understanding all the ways in which religion can have an impact in conflict spaces.
Oh, yeah, that's a soapbox that I get on often, which is the religion is too complex and it's too polarizing or it's too difficult, so we're just going to avoid it, which I guess at least that's kind of what I was understanding from what you were just explaining from the UN, which is this is not a We Hate the UN podcast by any means. Like I do think that, you know, they're kind of working with what they're given, but I've seen a very similar reaction and posture within the sciences as well of like, you can't just strap a blood pressure cuff to somebody and like measure how religious they are. And so because it's so difficult to understand and to measure and to gauge, we're just going to avoid it altogether.
To give you an example of that, in one of some of the documents that I had a look at when doing this kind of research, the explicit instruction that the UN gave its mediators on the ground level was, you know, if religion is important in the conflict context you're working in, then what you might want to do is get a religious mediating institution to do the religious mediation. Again, that just implies that we as the UN, we deal with a dimension of the conflict, which is the political one. And let's just let others do the religious element. That's too messy, too complicated for us. That's not something that we do.
Yeah. And again, similar to sciences, what we need is people like us who are interdisciplinary, who can kind of, I call myself like kind of bilingual, right? Like you can talk politics, you can talk religion. I can talk religion, I can talk public health. And those bilingual, bivocational professionals, I think that's the niche that I think we're trying to fill. And anyways, this isn't a hire Alejandro and Alejandra, but like also there's a reason that we study what we're studying. If you're enjoying today's discussion, don't forget to subscribe to the Healing Theology podcast on your favorite streaming platform. You can also visit us at healingtheology.com for more resources, show notes, and to join our growing community. You can also find us on social media at Healing Theology on all major social media platforms. Now, let's get back to our conversation. Let's shift gears real quick and talk directly about a place that, as you already mentioned, is really near and dear to both of us, which is our home country of Colombia. I think our listeners might benefit from a quick summary of why peacebuilding efforts was and is so important and needed in our country over the past couple of years. Can you give us like a bird's eye view summary of the recent history of the country?
Yeah, just for some context, Colombia's recent history has been marked by a long and very violent conflict involving guerrilla groups like the FARC, the ELN, paramilitary militias, and government forces. The conflict started out over six decades ago because of deep social, political, and economic inequalities, but has over time transformed into a conflict over illicit economies like drugs, gold mining, human trafficking, smuggling, all kinds of illicit economies nowadays. And it's turned more into a war between cartels than it was a political conflict when it started out. And there's been nearly 10 million officially recognized victims, and that's only since 1985. But of course, the number is likely to be far higher. These are just those that are officially recognized. And over the last decade or so, the government's efforts and civil society's efforts to make peace have grown stronger. In 2016, for example, as we mentioned earlier, a peace deal was struck between the government and the FARC, which was at the time the largest guerrilla insurgency in Latin America and potentially the world. And today, peace building faces many, many challenges, including putting the peace agreement into action, dealing with ongoing violence and this organized crime violence in some areas of the country, and the main issue, addressing social and economic gaps across the country that allow violence to be recycled. And as I mentioned before, the current government has a very ambitious policy of total peace, which is trying to end all forms of armed conflict in the country by simultaneously negotiating with all organized armed groups while also working to advance socioeconomic transformations in the territories most affected by violence. And that they're trying to do that in order to tackle the root causes of conflict and stop its perpetuation. And I think it's too early to really say something about how that process is going. It's ongoing. The government is seated down with all these armed groups, and they're trying to enact these ambitious reforms. We'll see how that goes in the next 2 years of the government.
And can you tell us specifically about your involvement with these peace efforts? What have you been doing in this long process? I'm sure there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are working to kind of broker this peace and actually see the peace treaties lived out. But can you tell us more exactly about the projects or the tasks that you've been involved in during this peace building chapter of Colombia?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've tried to do ever since starting my PhD is not let academia suck me in too much and detach me from what I really care about, which is the ground level context and the victims and perpetrators, which is what I really, really do care about. So over the last 3 years, I have worked with a peace-building organization called Rodemos el Diálogo, where I've had the chance to engage in some wonderful work to support victims and former combatants in a number of Colombian regions. This work in particular seeks to build bridges in war-torn communities. It seeks to restore social tissue and to support the reintegration of former combatants into society. And when I'm not in Colombia, when I'm in Oxford, usually I engage in policy advocacy with both the Colombian and the UK governments. And I also do research and write about total peace. And just to give you recent examples, I'm currently finishing off a report that gives the High Commissioner for Peace a number of recommendations for the future of the government's peace policy and trying to address certain gaps in institutional memory that I've identified in the High Commissioner for Peace's office.
Amazing. And thank you for the work that you're doing. Like, this is, I think, the power of academia, which is it gives us the tools to go write these reports and like talk to these people and be involved with these organizations that are actually having direct impact, have boots on the ground, per se. Can you explain to us or mention how the Catholic Church was pivotal in helping broker the peace deals in Colombia? Can you tell us more about, again, the impacts that religion had in this like political peace building brokerage and how it might have some health effects downstream?
Yeah, well, the Catholic Church has and still has and still does. It's leveraged its moral authority and its legitimacy in the service of peace and reconciliation. And this has happened at all levels of Colombian society, including some really amazing work at the grassroots level, which often goes unnoticed. I recently had a chat with the Bishop of Apartado in Chocó, one of the poorest, most underdeveloped and conflict-ridden, perhaps, municipalities in Colombia. And, you know, you don't hear about all that goes on behind the scenes and all the amazing mediation work and peace-building work that the Catholic Church and religious leaders are doing with the communities themselves, with the armed actors themselves, to prevent killings, to prevent violence, to prevent territorial control and you know, the outbreak of all these horrible things. To give you also other examples, the church has been a key mediator in the peace processes with a number of small insurgent groups during the 1980s and 1990s with the FARC between 2012 and 2016, an absolutely key role in the success of the peace process, including through a visit of Pope Francis in 2017, following the signature of the agreement, which really gave an impetus to the agreement and its implementation. And is currently taken on quite the protagonist role in most, if not all, of the ongoing negotiating tables with armed groups.
As you're talking, I just imagine, and we'll talk about this in our next episode with Eduardo a little bit more, but what you're explaining right now of the church seeing, especially the church in Colombia, which I think in Latin America, I wonder if you would agree, Latin America is such a Catholic space, right? Like in the US context to our listeners, there's like religion kind of floating in the air. But I think in Latin America, it's kind of weaved into society, like it's part of the culture, I think. And the ways that the Catholic Church is kind of allowing its power to be used for good, to mediate peace is, I think, what the church should be doing all along. Like, I think that is, I don't understand why that's not like one of the core principles of how religious institutions work. And I think that there's a lot to be learned from the way Colombia has been handling these peace treaties and the ways religious institutions can learn from the Catholic Church in Colombia here in the U.S. and a lot of the somewhat peace brokering that needs to happen here in the U.S. as well. As you were talking about peacemaking, peacebuilding, and peacekeeping, you know, these are fundamental aspects of improving people's public health and well-being. Have you seen any peace efforts ripple into the improvements of Colombia's, you know, health structure or Colombians' health in their personal lives? Or is it too soon to really see that?
In all honesty, Alejandra, I don't know if we have the data to answer this question comprehensively, but I will give you three examples of the impact that I have seen the 2016 peace agreement on the health of Colombians. On one hand, the agreement had a very strong component of humanitarian demining. Much of it done by former combatants, which I think was a beautiful, beautiful initiative of getting the people who were planting the landmines on the ground, have them being removed years later. And this, of course, prevents people from falling victim to landmines and other explosive devices with the devastating health impacts that these kinds of accidents may have decades after conflict ends. And I think this is particularly important because the biggest victims of landmines around the world are children, especially boys who perhaps might be, you know, looking for scrap metal in what used to be a conflict zone decades ago, and they'll find something and it'll suddenly explode. I see a very evident link to health there. Another good example is the very ambitious reparations program for victims that is part of the country's transitional justice system, which involves a great deal of psychosocial work to really tackle the trauma faced by individuals and communities during wartime. And of course, this isn't easy. This needs, you know, long-term support for 10 million people. And in practice, it's quite tricky, but in theory and in paper, it's there and the focus is there. And I think the government has genuinely been trying to hone in on this psychosocial element of victimhood to prevent intergenerational trauma from reproducing cycles of violence. And finally, the agreement creates a series of administrative areas, let's call it like that, called the PEDETs, which are the regions most affected by the conflict and which the government has an active duty to prioritize when it comes to investment in infrastructure and in the provision of public services and public goods, with, of course, health infrastructure at its forefront. And we've seen, I'm not entirely sure about the exact number, but it might be three or four very large investments in improving health infrastructure in these PEDETs so far in a few years since the peace agreement was signed, and hopefully many more in the next 10 or 15 years to come. Who is feeling this improvement in health and to what extent is something that I can't really speak to. But what I do think is that these examples show the power of peace efforts to at least create the conditions for improving the health of Colombians, particularly in the most vulnerable segments of the population.
Yeah, that's something to consider as we're pouring time, energy, and money into brokering peace. It's making sure that it won't trickle down to the people who need it most. And so lifting from the bottom is going to be the best way to rebuild our country. Thank you so much for all of your insight and your wisdom. But especially for the work that you're doing. Like this is really important and impactful work. And I think in a world that feels, at least to me and probably to many of us, so broken and heavy, it's good to hear that things can actually heal and that peace is an option and that there's a path to rebuilding societies that have otherwise been really war torn. Do you have any other closing thoughts or anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, you touched on something earlier, which I think is worth amplifying, that I think the kind of research that you do, Alejandra, and your efforts to create space for conversation linking these two worlds, religion, public health, and opening up space for other kinds of disciplines, like peace building, is super important. It gives rise to very exciting interdisciplinary conversations, you know, bringing people with different worlds of knowledge to address intersecting global issues and experiences. I see so much value in pushing those boundaries of disciplines and of the so-called academic good practice. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being in this fight with me. I'm definitely leading the charge in trying to break down the so-called silos of academia, because the world is not put into these perfect departments and containers that don't interact with one another. So I'm going to ask you what I call the Furious Five. There are five questions that I ask all of my guests because I want to know who you are as a human instead of just who you are as the amazing researcher that you are. So if you're ready, I'm going to just go ahead and ask them to you. If you could instantly solve one challenge related to the intersection of public health and religion and peace building, what would it be and how would you envision the solution?
Wars are deeply disturbing for the mental health of individuals. I think we've talked about that at great length. However, in many religious communities around the world, or communities where religion is important, those discourses around mental health tend to be heavily stigmatized. I don't want to generalize, but in some communities, in some cases, this happens, which can lead conflict-affected individuals to reject the psychosocial support that they might need. My solution to this particular challenge has three elements. First, the normalization, this is ideally speaking, the normalization of spiritual guidance as a mechanism for managing trauma, so making it part of the toolbox of public health institutions. Second, the formation of faith-based support groups where individuals can come together to share experiences, engage in collective healing practices, and finally, a healthy level of collaboration with religious leaders and organizations in these affected communities for them to really be instrumental in disseminating information and resources on how to access support and to encourage it at the end of the day. That would be ideal. So really leaning on religious communities and their tools, their mechanisms, their legitimacy and moral authority to address mental health challenges and trying to bring that into the mainstream.
Amazing. Yeah. There's a couple of episodes in the podcast where we talk about religion and mental health specifically. And so you are among similar company there talking about mental health crises and the way that religion really drops the ball there.
Well, listen to those podcast episodes, everybody, please.
You've heard it here. What do you believe is the most significant obstacle that we need to overcome in the near future to improve the relationship between religion and health? And it could be, you know, it could be what we just talked about.
That's a very good question. I, at risk of reproducing other kinds of answers that maybe other people have given you, I do see the need to dismantle Western narratives about religion and health, probably even science more broadly, not going well together. Perhaps, yeah, spotlighting the role of religious communities in improving health through practices, customs, etc. Because we in the West have lots to learn about how indigenous, in inverted commas, communities and spiritual knowledge have a role to play in healing, and how faith and spirituality are intertwined with health practices. And I think that starts with perhaps nurturing stronger allyship and synergies between religious and health authorities in certain contexts, which could really allow public health models, at least in the West, to exploit the healing potential of faith.
Absolutely. I'm gonna need you to come into my department and tell all my professors that, because they do not believe me. We really have to stop believing this oil and water thing with religion and science. Like, it's such a lie. It's such a lie. But let me not get into that. On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendations, be it a book or a podcast or show or anything like that?
So there's two things I'd like to talk to here. And the first one is a wonderful book by Rupa Maria, who's a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, and Raj Patel, this brilliant, brilliant economist, which connects global health disparities to colonialism, racism, poverty, and capitalism more generally. Capitalism understood as a political and economic system. The book is titled Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Mm. And the reason why I think there's a very good link to the kind of question that you've just asked me is that their concept of deep medicine sees human health as intertwined with spiritual health. And the author invites us to incorporate traditional and alternative, which they perhaps misleadingly call indigenous forms of knowledge into our approach to healing. And then there's a second thing I want to talk about, and it's this set of free online courses by an organization called Guardians Worldwide. They have a particular course that I think, if people are interested, I find very valuable. And it's called The Healing, which looks at the relationship between planetary and religious health, making connections between climate change, healing, and traditional medicine, and at the same time centering spirituality as a key knowledge system at the core of these issues.
That's amazing. Wait, I haven't heard about either of those before. And so I personally will be checking them out, but we'll also have them linked on our show notes as well for people to check out. That's really cool. Where are you finding joy and hope these days?
The sunshine coming in through my window in the morning, I'd say. I think I've gotten used to the bad British weather. And now that I'm in the US, I think I've come to take a lot of pleasure from seeing the sun coming in through my window.
Absolutely. And lastly, where can people connect with you?
People can shoot me an email. I'm sure you'll be able to give anyone interested my email, or they can shoot me a message on LinkedIn, Alejandro Posada Telles. I'd be happy to connect.
Awesome. Alejandro, thank you so much for just a really important and exciting conversation. Again, thank you for the work that you're doing, and best of luck as you continue your PhD.
We're excited. Thank you, Alejandra. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation, and thanks for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Theology Podcast. We hope today's episode brought you new insights and inspired you to think differently about the intersection of religion and public health. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as it really helps others find this podcast. And remember to subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. For more information, resources, and today's show notes, and also to connect with us, please visit us at healingtheology.com. Until next time, stay curious, stay compassionate, and keep the conversation going.